many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in. Before it's washed to the sea, how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind by Bob Dylan. And this song became really known as a peace song, an anti-war song, a protest song, if you will, coming out of the Vietnam War. Although Bob Dylan says that was not his intention, but certainly the people, the world, embraced this song and the lyrics to really stand by those words and really state the idea that what is war all about and how can we understand it better. If I was to say to you 1815, 1865, 1945 and 1975, the years that wars have ended in our history, what wars were they? Now, we know Dr. Stephen. He was formerly the Professor of History and Head of Department of International Studies at the American University of Sharjah, but moving on and is now Academic Director at Emirates Diplomatic Academy and Professor of History, of course. That's how we know him and how he is here with us today.
Great to be back.
It's great to have you here, and congratulations. Please let me congratulate you on your new position.
Well, it's really exciting, and EDA, Emirates Diplomatic Academy, is going to be a game changer, and it is a I'm absolutely thrilled to be playing a part in its development.
Well, we'll find out a little bit more about EDA in a while, but to get into our history, and we are looking at the end of wars. Now, why that in particular? What inspired you to want to discuss this morning?
Well, you know, it is in fact the anniversaries, the end of war and why it matters. End of war is a very interesting sort of thing to talk about. People usually talk about the wars. We have movies about wars. We have people's memories. But why a war ends is interesting. And what I think we'll find this morning is that sometimes wars end differently from one another, and sometimes they don't end as we think they did. But one other thing about war to remember, usually it is a supreme collective effort, at least on the part of the victor, often also on the part of the vanquished. The end of war, then, is something that people are almost inevitably excited by, relieved to experience. And unfortunately, sometimes there are some shocks to the system to come. And one other thing, the end of war is also the brings about the possibility of a better world each time it happens. And unfortunately, it doesn't always play out that way, but sometimes it has.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? The end of war, and I know there's actually, I was looking at World War II, 1945, but when you're looking at dates, the actual official date of the end of that war, there's still disagreement about that for various reasons. And also, it doesn't end on the moment that a treaty is signed, a piece of paper is signed. You know, what happens around the end of a war to the countries that have been involved until to the world as a bigger place? There are certain things that we're going to be talking about.
I think that the end of war is usually very messy because wars themselves are very complex, and they usually dislocate the economies, the social structures, and to put it more generally, the lives of many women and men who are involved. And so it should not surprise us that even if a treaty is signed or a declaration of war is, you know, finished with a surrender by one power, that in fact there's still a lot of hard work And in fact, a great need to stabilize sometimes beaten or vanquished foes. So the end of wars have proven to be very tricky, and they're even sometimes tricky for the victors. All you have to do is take a look after World War II at what happens when you demobilize all the soldiers. They come home, they are not necessarily as socialized, they're not quite as they were when they left. They behave badly, and you know, sometimes it's shocking, sometimes it's funny, but usually there is a transition, and if it's managed well, if things work out, the end of war, the war recedes. Sometimes end of war is the beginning of other conflicts.
The healing, the recovery, and how the world moves on after a big war, a big incident, a conflict that's impacting so many people. You mentioned there the movies have been made, and of course that's how most of us sort of know anything about our history, is probably looking at and watching movies. I was watching a clip earlier, the Battle of Waterloo, which came out in the early 70s, about a war. You know, it's a piece of entertainment, so how factually accurate it was about the day that the Battle of Waterloo broke out is another matter. But it begs the question, and I want to ask the listeners, your favourite war movie, do you have one? Or any movie that's impacted you in some way. Flying back from America just a few days ago, I watched The Imitation Game, and such a superb movie, focusing on the life of Alan Turing. And Alan Turing was a very interesting character that really has only just come to light to the public in recent years. And yet he was responsible, many will say, for pretty much, not just the end of World War II, but winning the war for Britain and the Allies. He and his team broke the Enigma Code. And, okay, again, it's a piece of entertainment. It's a work of fiction. It's a movie. But I learned so much watching that movie, just getting that insight into that time in the world, in Britain, and during World War II. The Enigma Code, and also, really, he was the forerunner of computers, creating and understanding the mechanics behind computers.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting thing about wars, too, is that it's probably been the case for most of human history, but certainly in the last century or two, wars are accelerants, and what they tend to do is promote technologies, and they mean that and technologies that seem far-fetched or seem like a dream to somebody in a peaceful period might become a priority of a government that's trying to find a weapon or an improved communication system or some other efficiency. And so one of the things that when we look at wars, we're talking about, yes, we're talking about battle. We're talking about, you know, huge loss of life, dislocation of populations, rearrangement of borders. But sometimes we're also talking about technological developments that might not happen otherwise.
Do you have a particular movie, a favorite movie that stands out for you?
You know, I don't know that I have a favorite movie. I guess I might say, and be a little bit of a nerd historian here, and say Tora, 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 simply because it did such a faithful job of replicating the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. It tried to get it right. We rewatched Saving Private Ryan, and, you know, it depends what you're looking at them for. What one doesn't want to see is something that is completely doing violence to the facts. But, you know, a movie like Saving Private Ryan has its ups and downs, but it gets to the human drama at many levels.
And it's not to necessarily glorify war. That's not what we're talking about today. But it's what we can glean from and understand from history.
Yeah, and I think most war movies are not glorifications of war, but one could make a very interesting observation that you have war movies. There's one, Battle of Waterloo, made in 1913. The world then goes to war the next year. And, you know, one could make a very interesting linkage between the way people are entertained by that kind of war movie and the sort of fascination and passion that many people now have for video games, which enable people to go beyond watching a war privately, but in some ways to participate in it, at least psychologically and emotionally.
So, Stephen, to give us an overview of what we're going to be getting into, the wars we're going to be looking at, the end of wars, 1815, the Battle of Waterloo and the defeat of Napoleon, 1865 and the end of the American Civil War, and then 1945, the end of World War II, and 1975, end of the American War, or the Vietnam War, as many call it.
Yeah, and these are four selections that are interesting to me for very different reasons. I'm choosing them, exploiting the anniversaries that they all end in five. So that was one thing. But there's usually something we can learn from each of them. When we talk about 1815 for a moment, we will, and I'll come back and talk about this. We're talking about the end of the Napoleonic Wars, which in fact was a global conflict. When we're talking about 1865, we're talking about the end of the American Civil War, where an early example of what a total war could be, and one in which more Americans died than in any other. When we talk about World War II, we're talking about the greatest collective act in terms of numbers of people involved, probably in human history. And we're talking about 1975. We're talking about, to put it from the Vietnamese point of view, the American War. And it is the one that is known to us in films and movies and popular culture. Bob Dylan, I think he knew what he was doing, and it was part of the, sort of stoking the fires of protest. But it is, in looking at that war, it's often misunderstood. And so it's 40 years is a good time to look back on it as well.
And that's what the history books say. And we're talking about history and looking at the end of wars with Dr. Stephen Keck. He's a professor of history. He's also the academic director at the Emirates Diplomatic Academy in Abu Dhabi. We're going to start with Waterloo and the Battle of Waterloo, where, yes, Napoleon in the end stood down. But there's a whole story and reality around this battle. The battle took place in 1815. So the Battle of Waterloo. Dr. Stephen, the significance of this battle.
Well, this is where Napoleon is finally defeated, and it's the events that leading up to it are utterly fascinating. But even before I tell you that, Napoleon is fascinating, and he's worth always trotting out onto the stage of history. He's born in 1769, so he is 20 years old when the French Revolution takes place in 1789, and he is totally shaped by it. And one of the things that about Napoleon is that he is a military genius. He is somebody who, before the French Revolution, would have been a soldier. He was a minor noble from a place called Corsica, which did not ingratiate him in Paris. In fact, they made fun of him as he grew up. He had a funny accent. He was short, which is one of the reasons I like him. And he was not anybody you would have predicted would, in essence, become emperor of Europe, the strongest political figure in Europe since Charlemagne, which is, in fact, what happens. And the reason for all of this is that Napoleon works extremely hard, and is constantly calculating. He rises on merit. This was something that was impossible before the French Revolution. He rises on merit. In 1798, he's already a fairly well-known figure. He's beaten an Austrian army. He's performed well against the British. He goes to Egypt. And here the world deserves some good Napoleon in Egypt movies. I know there have been some that have been made, but there probably can be better ones made. His soldiers discover the Rosetta Stone. It opens up Egyptology. Napoleon is beaten by Lord Nelson in the Battle of the Nile. He gets back to France, and he begins to build this very powerful coalition. And
that's huge, isn't it? Already in his life, what he's gone through, good or bad, is quite phenomenal.
There are only three or four people in history that do something like this. And anyway, so Napoleon, to cut things short, becomes the dominant political figure in Europe, but he cannot beat the British because in 1805, Lord Nelson again defeats a French-Spanish fleet, which is Napoleon's fleet at Trafalgar. And so your listeners who've been to London and been to Trafalgar Square, this is what that is named after. And just about the same time, Napoleon is winning all sorts of victories on the continent. Fast forward, Napoleon crowns himself emperor. Napoleon makes, as your listeners will know, the classic military blunder. He invades Russia in 1812. It's the defeat that undermines his power. It gave the world, since we're talking about movies, gives the world a piece of music, very famous, 1812 Overture, because Tchaikovsky was later obsessed by Napoleon. And for those of you that are out there and have nothing to do and you want to read a novel, War and Peace, 1,400 pages.
Yes.
It's a good read, and maybe not the first you'll take to the beach. But anyway...
An amazing book.
Amazing. And so this event is the Napoleon's undoing. He's eventually defeated. He is then put into exile in a very nice place, Elba Island. And it's not fair. Imagine, you get, you know, turn the world upside down and you're exiled to a nice, sunny Mediterranean climate. Most people would be very happy. However, Napoleon escapes exile in March 1815, is greeted as a hero in France, and the wars are about to start up. Now, one other thing. While this is happening, the Congress of Vienna is meeting to try to figure out what Europe's going to look like after the war, because they think the war is over and then Napoleon appears. Okay, so since we're talking about movies, think about if there's a second or third Poltergeist movie. This is what it would have been like to live and finally see that Napoleon is exiled and he's come back to life, and the French soldiers are rallying around him. When he is defeated at Waterloo, it ends all that. It ends this last chance.
But hang on
a
minute, though, Stephen. How does he? So in one minute he's exiled, right, and he's on Elba, and the next minute he fights out. So, you know.
He escapes.
Right.
He escapes. And then as he lands in France, he is embraced. He is incredibly popular. Everywhere he goes, memories of the victories of older soldiers, the memories of things that Napoleon did to make France great. And all of this against the background that they're negotiating a treaty in Vienna that might not be kind to France. So he is a popular hero, a returning, conquering hero, and the soldiers rally around him, and he then is suddenly faced with a coalition against him. It's called the Seventh Coalition, and it includes the British and the Prussians and the Russians, because for them, Napoleon is a very real threat. And so Napoleon goes into Belgium with his army to try to defeat the British and the Prussians and to intimidate the rest of Europe so that he can probably get some sort of peace settlement. And that's where the Battle of Waterloo takes place.
So June the 18th, Napoleon leads his army of some 72,000 troops against the 68,000-man British army, which had taken up a position south of Brussels near the village of Waterloo. And the British army, which included Belgian, Dutch and German troops, commanded by Arthur Wellesley, Duke of Wellington as we know him, That's the beginning of the... And how long did this battle take place?
Well, there's several skirmishes before in sort of mid-June 1815 that leads Napoleon to believe he can do something he has done successfully before, which is he knows the Prussians are out there trying to join up with Wellington. And if the Prussians join with Wellington, he will face a much bigger army. So his idea is to use speed and mobility, these tactics that he was very good at, to first defeat the British and then attack the Prussians and defeat them almost before they knew what happened. And so this was his ambition. He had done something like this. Your listeners may know this if they've ever played war games, either the board kind or the ones we have today, Battle of Austerlitz. And he was trying to repeat something like that. The problem he faced was that the British units were very good. The window in which he is going to try to beat these two armies is actually very small.
Looking here, it seems like fascinating. It's saying, possibly a critical blunder, Napoleon waited until midday to give the command to attack in order to let the waterlogged ground dry after the previous night's rainstorm. The delay gave Blücher's remaining troops, who by some accounts numbered more than 30,000, time to march to Waterloo and join the battle later that day.
Yeah, and Napoleon's general Ney was supposed to be able to hold them off, and he's unable to do it. It is very easy to second-guess Napoleon here. It also gave Wellington time to get better organized on the high ground. It's also the case that you'd have to say that if you were going to move forward, wet ground is not necessarily the best way for infantry to march. So I would give Napoleon a little more credit here. I think the circumstances were against him, even in the best case scenario.
So this battle takes place, and this is in the 1800s. It's 1815. So for us to get an understanding of what a battle was like of that time compared to battles in more recent years.
Well, okay, this is the 200th anniversary, okay? And to get the best way to explain this is if your listeners are very interested, they could probably Google Wellington reenactment. And Waterloo reenactment. And what they would probably find is people dressed as Napoleonic era soldiers reenacting this battle at Waterloo. So what was it like? First of all, if you are wounded, it is a significant problem. There the sort of medical ability to evacuate soldiers is very poor. And it's also the case that in a way that's stunning, given the way war developed subsequently, how soldiers faced each other and fired, okay? Often in very nice parade ground quality uniforms, very visible, sometimes not using camouflage the way it would become ordinary in subsequent conflicts. It's hard fought, and the soldiers are semi-professional in many cases. Napoleon's forces, he had at the very end of the battle, he deploys the old guard, his most experienced troops, and they're really good crack troops. They simply don't have the energy and the time to win. And partly also look at the tactics. Wellington devised a series of squares, interlocking squares, to maximize firepower. So if you were to look at what it was like for the experience of a soldier, pretty terrifying.
Terrifying indeed, as all wars are. And looking at the end of wars to understand better the implication on the world as a bigger place and also for us living today. When we come back, we'll talk more about Napoleon and what happened in those final hours, and after that, what happened after the Battle of Waterloo, before we get into more recent wars. And Dr. Stephen Keck joins me, and I've just been into your homeland travelling for the last few weeks and recovering from jet lag, but very much looking forward to this discussion. We were in correspondence whilst I was away, Dr. Stephen, and talking about history, and in particular focusing on the end of wars and looking at Waterloo to begin with, but we'll be looking at also the American Civil War and the World War II, and also looking at towards the end of the show at Vietnam, the war, America's war against Vietnam, and the outcomes there and what we can draw with lessons learned and parallels, I suppose. Now, as Dr. Stephen was saying earlier, it's also about why and how these wars are ended, and what we can sort of glean from those. And often, even though the treaty is signed, it doesn't end there, and how this all interconnects with other conflicts around the globe through history. So really interesting getting into this. We've just been looking at the Battle of Waterloo and the defeat of Napoleon, and it was actually quite funny to me to see that there is an expression. If you say someone has met his Waterloo, it means the person has suffered a decisive or final defeat or setback, which is what happened to Napoleon. It was in 1815, June, and it was a battle of various sorts and sizes. But the significance in history, Dr. Stephen, as you've outlined, but also really Napoleon, good or bad, he was deemed a great soldier and leader, even though it didn't work for him in the end. Now, some are saying that the reasons for that, the reasons, the defeat, there was a lot of circumstances. He was outnumbered. Others are saying that he was not feeling so great. He had been in exile on Elba. And in fact, one of our listeners is asking, how long was he? Ahmed, good morning to you. How long was he in exile on Elba? Well, 10 months he was on Elba. Reportedly saying fatigued and in poor health during the Belgian campaign. Napoleon committed tactical errors and acted indecisively. He also was blamed for appointing inadequate commanders. And ultimately, the Battle of Waterloo marked the end of Napoleon's storied military career. He reportedly rode away from the battle in tears.
Yeah, and I think that if you really were to look at it and say, what if Napoleon had been successful at Waterloo in a kind of counterfactual way, I really doubt that it would not have things would be greatly different in the long run, because the major powers of Europe were not going to let Napoleon reappear and dominate the continent, and therefore, the scenarios where Napoleon might win several victories, but the coalition against him probably would not change. So, in all probability, what Waterloo does is nicely ends the war. Nice, decisive stroke. And often, when history is written, historians and the general public, movie makers, people that want to remember history, like history when it ends that way, likes an event that ends that way. The other thing to remember about it, though, is the Congress of Vienna is still meeting. And in fact, this becomes a very significant event in itself, because they then do something that's unprecedented. They try to restore Europe to the pre-1789 conditions. Now, this is an ambitious thing, but what I would tell everybody is that it's also the beginnings of, some people call it the beginnings of modern diplomacy. The idea being that if you bring the major powers, their representatives, their diplomats together, put them around a table, let them try to come up with a settlement, they are doing more than ending war. To end war, maybe you're just stopping shooting at each other, but to actually try to do something different, which is to build conditions for peace, for sustainability, for creating a world in which powers, people that have fought each other, can begin to trust each other, that is actually as difficult in some ways as it is to prosecute a war. And the Congress of Vienna has had its critics, but one would have to say it's striking how few wars Europe has for the next 99 years. So this is the way the Napoleonic Wars end, and you clearly see it kind of as the end of an era when it takes place.
You've recently taken up a new position. You've been on the show many times in your role as Professor of History and Head of Department of International Studies at the American University of Sharjah. You've now taken up a position as Academic Director at the Emirates Diplomatic Academy in Abu Dhabi. And so it's kind of fitting. We're talking here about diplomacy in stages 200 years ago, and here we are in the era that we're living through. And diplomacy and what that stands for, is it still the same definition?
I think you probably find the same definition, but one of the things that's very interesting is the role of diplomats has changed, and what diplomats reflect is a change in nation states. So if one wanted to, one could say that, you know, maybe the first diplomats are little more than spies if you go back several centuries, and maybe that, you know, one could then look at something like the Peace of Westphalia, where they tried to end religious strife in Europe in 1648. With the Congress of Vienna, you had something else. You had an attempt to sort of restore monarchs and create conditions of peace that would last for a long time. And in fact, it is the forerunner to something that we can talk about again in 1945, when the United Nations is actually devised. And so the role of diplomats has actually changed over time, and it's probably fair to say that given all of the changes that we are living through, informational, environmental, social, cultural, and so on, that we will probably see the practice of diplomacy modify to meet existing circumstances. So it is a fascinating time to study the subject.
One of our listeners is texting to say the parallels between Napoleon and the German Operation Barbarossa in World War II are very interesting to draw, culminating in the horrific Stalingrad defeat. There's a book our listener's recommending for us by Anthony Beaver, who actually has appeared at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature here in Dubai. This book is about Stalingrad and what happened there.
I think it's an excellent recommendation. It is instructive to look at these two campaigns. There's also quite a lot to be gleaned from the first year of Hitler's invasion, Operation Barbarossa. It's also late starting, which is interesting. It also starts in June. But because the first wave is sort of defeated right at the gate of Moscow, which is Napoleon actually gets into Moscow and then discovers that much of the city is burned. But the whole sort of scorched earth approach to fighting, which is to make sure that the Russian army can keep retreating and not be drawn into a big battle until it is ready, to use the terrain, to use the distance, to use the winter, all of those things the Russians use superbly against Napoleon and as they did against Hitler.
I wonder if Hitler, or you look at certain leaders, look at other leaders in history for inspiration. Do you think he looked to Napoleon for inspiration?
Generally speaking, I think leaders like this are rare. They have large egos. I think they do. I think Napoleon looked back himself to Hannibal for tactics. And I think Hitler Hitler had other reasons to invade the Soviet Union. He didn't trust Stalin. He thought at some point a war between Stalin and Nazi Germany was probably inevitable. They had been bitter rivals in the 1930s. But all of that said, yes, I think there's a psychological dynamic in Hitler's mind as well that does not help him here.
Salam text in regarding, you mentioned ego there, and he says, end of war happens when we heal ourselves from ego, lust for power and greed on an individual level. Salam saying you have to transform yourself first for peace, and to, you know, what he's really talking about here is to remove war and conflict from the world. So there's an interesting point of view. But ego, yeah.
Ego, and it's also why diplomacy matters. Hard to write about things that never happen, but there's no doubt that if nations do talk to each other, if they make compromises, if they find ways to mediate, if they share resources, if they are comfortable engaging one another and do so with sensitivity to each other's cultures, the chances for war breaking out are greatly diminished.
So there is the Battle of Waterloo, and we've been asking you this morning for those films that stand out in your mind that feature war, and there's many coming in, Stephen. We've got The Thin Red Line from Jesse. A few of you have texted in, actually. Interesting, you're picking Braveheart. Now, again, you know, where we are looking at popular culture, entertainment, movies, and how we remember or think of certain things, it's interesting. It could be about how well a film is made that makes a certain piece of history stand out or in our memories, not necessarily the actual history itself. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, and I think one of the things, for example, about Braveheart that's very good is it was overcoming a romantic view of the Middle Ages that, you know, one could call Arthurian, that, you know, that there was Prince Arthur, there's King Arthur in the Round Table. And in fact, if you look at Braveheart, the way the social conditions are portrayed of the people in Scotland, you realize this is nothing to romanticize. So Braveheart has a number of merits, and one of the things I liked about the film was its brutal realism.
Keep your messages coming in on 4001. Good morning to Kevin. Always good to hear from you. And I know he always has an interest in history and our conversations. And he's saying some of the classics there, actually, when it comes to the movies. Bridge Over the River Kwai, Dam Busters as well. And just for the classic of the movie, but also the soundtrack.
Yeah, no, these are classics. And in fact, one can also go look at the time in which they were made. Portray a certain attitude and a stance towards the Germans in the war, the Japanese. It's also quite telling. But they are kind of Hollywood classics. One I would add to that list is The Great Escape.
And when we come back, we're going to take a look at war again, end of a war. This time a civil war. That is the American Civil War. So stay with us.
On December 20th, 1860, just over 1 month after the election of Abraham Lincoln to the presidency of the United States, South Carolina did the unthinkable and seceded from the Union. Now in the spring of 1861, militia from the first state to secede was about to be the first to fire on the flag of the nation they had once sworn allegiance to. Newly promoted Brigadier General Pierre Gustave Toutant Beauregard was placed in command of 6,000 militiamen and 60 heavy guns and mortars recently seized from the federal arsenals and navy yards. Nearly every one of those muskets, cannons, and mortars were aimed at the powerful federal bastion guarding the mouth to Charleston Harbor, Fort Sumter. Beauregard had sent a note to the federal commander defending the fort, demanding that he pack up his troops and get out, or else. That commander was Major Robert Anderson of Kentucky, who ironically had been Beauregard's artillery instructor at West Point. The luckless Anderson wired his superiors in Washington for instructions. Newly inaugurated President Lincoln knew he could not withdraw the troops, no matter how hopeless resistance seemed. To do so would be to recognize the southern states' right to disunite and shatter the nation forever. When Lincoln refused to give the order to evacuate the fort, the Confederate government, fearing that failure to act might compromise the independent status of their new nation, decided it could no longer wait. At 4:30 a.m., the bombardment of Fort Sumter began.
So moving through history and looking at the end of wars and giving us there a little setup to the beginning of a civil war, that is the American Civil War that started in 1865. And this part of history, of course, you are from America. You have spent many years working and lecturing at the American University of Sharjah. And all the more poignant, I think, for you, Stephen, because of the loss for the American University of Sharjah and for you, a dear friend, and, of course, for the family members of your colleague.
Yeah, I want to just start by paying tribute to the memory of my friend Richard Gasson, who perished in March in a traffic accident. He, along with one of his friends, it was sudden. It was very hard. It's very hard for the campus. It was very hard to teach the students the next day, particularly many of our majors who were had been his students, and in fact. It was very hard because they liked Richard very much as a teacher, as they should. He is appropriate to remember here because he was a historian of the United States. He, as an American historian, may have been, he believed he was the only one in the GCC at the time. And so he brought the study of America to the UAE. He wrote a lovely book on the beginnings of American tourism. And he was a really adept at telling a story. He could add color. He had a marvelous sense of humor. And he was a very strong teacher as well. And one of the things that I enjoyed was watching the way he would teach writing. And so he was his loss has bothered his students, his colleagues, our family for ever since. And as I move into this segment here on American history, I just want to pay tribute to him because he really was a fine teacher, great scholar in his way, and he is still missed.
Mm.
The clip that you played is personal to me in another way, which is Charleston. I taught the College of Charleston for 4 years, and in fact, April 12, 1861, is when the war was where the war breaks out. And for those of you who may not know a lot about U.S. history, the American Civil War is the war in which more Americans are killed than any other. It is a total war. Many parts of the South are devastated. And it is, in fact, a war that people wrongly think is fought over slavery. It is, as your clip suggests quite rightly, it is actually fought over whether the South could form its own country, whether it could succeed from the actual Union. The underlying cause, one of the biggest ones, is slavery. So, in fact, it's not wrong to connect the two, but it is not the formal reason why the war was started. It is a war that Americans continue to be emotional. If one more war movie, I'll put it on here. Glory is one that I always tear up as I see it. So to talk about the way the war ends, it ends in 1865. The South is defeated. It's great General Robert E. Lee's forces are basically in retreat, they're exhausted. They have lost. Despite fighting an army they dominated for several years, they lost because the South did not have the industrial muscle of the North. The North had a much better overall strategy, so by 1865, large parts of the South are occupied. The North is also doing things to enlist African-American former slaves to create military units to increase its military power. The movie Glory focuses on this. And so the war is over in April 1865 at Appomattox Courthouse when Lee surrenders, and with it a new era in American history begins. And it's not coincidental, maybe, that if you've seen the movie Lincoln, which is not a war movie, Lincoln is assassinated almost right afterwards. So this war, it was devastating for the United States. Had the war turned out differently, the world history would have been differently because you would have had two countries as opposed to one that turns into a superpower. One other thing I wanted to talk about today with 1865, it is the 150th anniversary of the end of this conflict, and your listeners will be aware that there was a terrible shooting in Charleston in the spring that was racially motivated. Now, my office was less than a mile from that place. I know the city well.
That's this year.
Yes, this year. And it led to a debate about the Confederate flag, whether the Confederate flag, which was the flag the South flew in the war, should be on the State House where it had been flying. Now, the reason I want to mention this today is because that flag actually doesn't fly in the state capitol from about 1865 till 1960. It is mobilized in 1960 when the South goes through civil rights. And again, it's in South Carolina. The flag is mobilized as a symbol of memory, Confederate flag. So when we talk about war, we talk about the way they end. It's also important the way they end and the way they are remembered. And so many people flying the Confederate flag, they have it on bumper stickers, they have on college dormitory walls. These people have no idea how hard this war was. For them, it is a symbol of identity. And one of the things to ponder when we talk about war is the way war furnishes very significant symbols for people to identify with.
Yeah, that's so true, isn't it? The flag and how something is remembered and carried through and altered as well to suit somebody's personal circumstance or point of view or opinion. Also, what's interesting, and it's a whole show in itself, is the nature of civil war and the impact on maybe the world, but actually to begin with, a country in itself, and that's got to be a fascinating area.
It is, and it's why Americans basically often get so interested in the U.S. Civil War that they can be, it's very difficult for people to understand. It's one of the reasons I don't do American history. In fact, I'm happier to do global history. But even in my family, there are stories about people, you know, the two brothers saw each other, fought against each other. Most of this is all not true because you turn around and find that every family has a story like this. But there is no doubt that a civil war is wrenching and that you have many people that were friends previously that got along, that may have intermarried, and they are brutally separated in the war, and sometimes these relationships never recover, even when the peace is ongoing.
150 years down the line since the American Civil War, is it still felt in America? The North South, is there a North South divide?
That's a fascinating question. I would think the answer is yes. And I remember the comment that was made in 1976. When Jimmy Carter was elected president, and people said, this now ends the Civil War, because the South has a very difficult time in the Reconstruction period. This is when you see some of the worst racism come out in America. This is the era where the Ku Klux Klan, for example, has its roots, when you could probably say crypto-fascist violence against African Americans took place in many southern states. It was also a time of great poverty. The wealth of the Gilded Age in American history of, you know, railroads and capitalism and economic expansion passed a lot of the South by, which did not encourage a more tolerant racial climate. So for the South, it is a it's a fascinating but very difficult generations. And it's why, by the way, if you talk to Southerners, they're such good storytellers. Jimmy Carter's election, 1976, the South does a lot better in the last few decades. William Jefferson Clinton is from Arkansas. So one could overstate but the South, North-South divide, but it's still there. And for the families that have roots in it, it will be there for a long time to come.
We've been asking you about movies that feature war, and rather timely there, Marquette's just texting with Gone with the Wind.
Absolute classic.
Talking with Dr. Stephen Keck, who is Academic Director at Emirates Diplomatic Academy in Abu Dhabi. He's a Professor of History. Always a pleasure to have Stephen on, getting his insights, his knowledge. You know what? I had a camera to show you. He has nothing with him. This is all in his head. No piece of paper, no computer. How you carry and remember all of this information, Stephen, but that's the life of a historian.
Yes, and historians were an odd bunch, but happily so. I would say this, though. It comes from teaching and having a broad vision of the profession and understanding that we're basically teaching a human subject, and there are things in it that are so compelling that we don't forget. Any really good historian though realizes how little they really know about humanity's past because the subject is so big.
Well, we've been looking at certain wars and the end of them. So far, we've discussed the Waterloo, just marking 200 years. Yeah. 1815, the Battle of Waterloo. And then we took a look at the American Civil War, which ended in 1865. We're going to go on and have a look at 1945 and the end of World War II, and then 1975, the end of the American War, or the Vietnam War, as many of us know it. And taking a look at some of those movies that have come in, Majdi's saying Saving Private Ryan, Thin Red Line, and he's saying absolutely fantastic World War II movies. Also here we have, actually quite in detail, The Liberator. Now, the listener that's texted this in recommending The Liberator, it's about Simon Bolivar, who liberated five countries without ambitions for conquest, including Canada and Central America.
Well, now, I haven't had the pleasure of seeing that movie. I think it's an excellent choice. But one thing I would want our listeners to understand, and we talk about Simon Bolivar, you're talking about a figure who does liberate much of South America from Spanish colonialism in particular. And this is something that comes out of the Napoleonic conflicts, because if it wasn't for the Napoleonic conflicts, the Spanish would have been not weakened, and probably a very different set of outcomes would have occurred, and much of South America would have stayed under Spanish rule much longer. So when we talk about the Battle of Waterloo and the end of the Napoleonic conflicts, it's a reminder, this wonderful contribution the listeners made, that yes, in Europe you get the stability of the provided by the Congress of Vienna, but it also unleashed so many other things that changed the world.
Bob says Breaker Morant.
Breaker Morant, fantastic movie. I would love to see it again. And it's set in the Boer War, and it brings the savagery of that conflict home. And one of the nice things about that movie was that it brought the movie out of South Africa, brought the experience of it out to audiences worldwide that probably knew very little bit about it. And it came out of the movie in the early 80s, but at the same time, another favorite I'll just mention in passing real quick, Gallipoli. And so in the early 80s, there were two excellent war movies that came out, as well as were there others.
Throughout the world, throngs of people hailed the end of the war in Europe. It is 5 years and more since Hitler marched into Poland, years full of suffering and death and sacrifice. Now the war against Germany is won. A grateful nation gives thanks for victory. Hundreds of thousands crowd into American churches to give thanks to God. President Truman announced the official surrender.
This is a solemn but glorious hour. I wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to see this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. For this victory, we join in offering our thanks to the Providence which has guided and sustained us.
So listening there, the end of the World War II, and the news coverage coming out of the United States. This is the World War II in Europe, German surrender, 1945, World War II footage. Wow, it's quite dramatic. And it was dramatic, of course, in reality, but it's interesting just hearing the delivery of news and how that is put together of that time.
Yeah, it has its own drama, and it's probably worth taking a few minutes here to talk about World War II in a very general way. First of all, it is, I think, the largest collaborative effort of sort of human work, possibly in recorded human history, because if you take a look at the soldiers involved, the civilians that are actually involved in the combat, you get part of the story. But if you look at the logistics, you look at the factories, you look at the way whole economies were changed for many years, you're talking about an enormous collaborative effort, and one that was not something that people did because they wanted to, but usually because they had to. And therefore, when the war was over, it probably would have surprised nobody that there was cause for great celebration. Now, just to muddy the water a little bit, because when we study history, we like to do that. The war is, the clip you play is excellent because it talked about Hitler going into Poland. And September 1st, 1945 is the way, so, sorry, 1939 is the way I learned this is when World War II begins. But that, of course, is from a European point of view. If you look at it from an Asian point of view, and remember the bridge, your listeners that talked about the Bridge of the River Kwai that have texted in, the Pacific War, Thin Red Line, another one, that when we talk about the Pacific War, it might make more sense to say it actually begins in 1931 when the Japanese invade Manchuria. And so from a Chinese point of view, okay, Hitler's invaded Poland. We've been at war for 8 years. And so that's one thing to remember, that when we talk about a war, we like them to be nice, clean events that have one bookend in one date and one bookend in the other, and they're not always that way. And nowhere is this more the case than we talk about the war in Asia and what happens afterward, which is highly significant. But
and if
war,
I can just come in
yes,
on that,
please,
exactly,
please.
You're absolutely right, is that we were listening to a newsreel like that, and these newsreels are, you know, depicting the time at the end of World War II in Europe. We are all aware of, I'm sure, of that image of Times Square, you know, in America, the celebrations, as you said, as VE Day occurs and President Truman announces the German surrender and US and Russian troops meet at the Elbe River. So there's these places and moments in time where these celebrations en masse are breaking out. But actually, what's interesting about the end of World War II is it's still quite a bit of disagreement as to when that war actually did end.
Well, yes, and let's go back and look at VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. And probably everybody has seen, about every 5 years you see it, the picture of the famous kiss in Times Square, where there's a sailor and he's kissing a woman that he doesn't know. And I think at one point they were reunited and people did a little television program about it. But this is this iconic picture, the war is over. And what you would find is the war's end being celebrated in Paris, in London, in New York, in Washington, in many other places. But what's even more interesting is what happens in Algeria. That is the day in which you have an Algerian resistance movement against the French begin to fight as if a new day has dawned. Okay, so that's one side. And, of course, the other side is the war in the Pacific is still going on. And in 19 VE Day, we still don't know how long it will take. Okay, so the United States is planning by this point, it's very clear who's going to win, it's clear the Japanese are on the defensive, but the United States and its allies are planning a massive invasion of Japan. And just to give you an idea, at least 500,000 Purple Hearts had been manufactured because the United States anticipates that when it invades Japan, the casualties will be sky high and they will have to give out at least 500,000 of these medals.
Which is the case. It was a massive hit on that country. And a little quote for you here on World War II. Created as it destroyed, gave as it stole. There's so much about this war, particularly, I guess, because it's a modern war. And from where we were talking earlier about the Battle of Waterloo and the American Civil War, we're now moving into an era which we can now start to really kind of relate to, because we've possibly got grandparents or great-grandparents connected to this time and place in history. And also, we're getting what, you know, as I would relate to listening to that newsreel, we're now getting technology where communications are moving around the world, or people are getting a certain point of view or representation, or as some might call it, propaganda about war. And that also, if you call that name, that use that word, that term muddy, could potentially muddy the reality of what was actually happening at the time.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about the end of World War II, it's very interesting because what happens in the Pacific is well known. In the end, you have two atomic bomb strikes, one on Hiroshima, one on Nagasaki, and the Japanese surrender. And the suffering of the populations in those two cities is remembered quite rightly. It might be remembered as well that the reasons for those American urgency was partly to prevent a lot of American casualties, but also to prevent the Russians from coming into the war and having a larger share of the peace. So one has to talk about that war by its ending. but also to realize it was a war when civilians have been bombed systematically in a way that had never been before. So this was a war of truly terrifying proportions that seems to have a nice end, and yet in some parts of the world there was remained a huge period of time in which instability, political fighting, warfare, and the struggle against colonialism then really begins to rear its head.
And as we are looking at the end of World War II and understanding better the events surrounding that, interesting, we were saying about even agreeing as to when that war formally came to an end. I think it was in May 1945, there was VE Day, and then August of that year, VJ Day. But then there's September the 2nd as well. I think that's at the formal surrender.
Formal surrender on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay, and give you one thing we could also talk about if you were the Missouri now museum, you can go see it in Puget Sound, Washington. That's the formal signature that ends the conflict, and with it a number of things in 1945. Is the beginning really of a new world, and it's not surprising given that this is a large collaborative effort. Since we've been talking a little bit along the way about diplomacy, it's also the beginning of the United Nations, comes in 1945, and it's not surprising that after a large conflict, you have people trying to find new ways to make sure it never happens again. There's also the thing that happens is that there's still at that time 1 million Japanese soldiers all over Asia, and demobilizing them, making sure that you can then restore some kind of order while you have others trying to sort of seize power. And the issue of crime is something that populations still had to deal with. So the day-to-day reality would have been, yes, we're glad the war is over. The Japanese are going to, leave. Maybe do we want to leave right now? Because they've been basically law and order for the last few years. And in fact, there's one other thing I'd want to say here, and I'd love to do this more formally, but it's also Singapore's 50th birthday. And if you were to really look at Lee Kuan Yew's memoirs, he talks very interestingly about what it was like to live in wartime Singapore. And the expectation was the British would come back, and they do come back, but it's actually very difficult for them. So the war is a transition in many, many ways, because in the case of Singapore, in the case of British Malaya, Burma, they simply don't have the means to rule these states. And so on the one hand, the war is over, but a new set of conflicts is just about to begin in Asia. And so people who study the history of Asia sometimes talk about a cycle of violence that doesn't really end until the defeat of the Khmer Rouge in 1979, and then Asia really blossoms in terms of economic prosperity.
It's been an incredible year for you, Dr. Stephen, on many different levels, and also to congratulate you on the publication of your book, British Burma in the New Century, 1895 to 1918.
Yeah, it's exciting. It was exciting to write, and it will be out in the fall. I mean, and it's in publication now. I think that what it does is highlights a period of British rule in Burma that's not really been studied. And I had the pleasure of going to London at this time last year and immersing myself in a lot of colonial records, and I enjoyed the book. I hope people read it, because it tells a human story. It focuses on a group of writers I call the Burmophiles. And these Burmophiles were British writers who went to Burma and kind of fell in love with the country, fell in love with the people, the landscape, the traditions, and tried in their own way to defend and celebrate Burma against the more typical forms of colonial racism. So there's a human story in it, but if you read them, it reveals a world that doesn't exist anymore. And so, yeah, it was a thrill to write it, and I'm very happy if we can make a small contribution to the world of both empire and Burma studies.
Yeah, and understanding that time. And the next time you visit us here at Dubai Eye, that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be looking at that era. And talking of that time, Sam's text in, and it's a totally reasonable text to write in, Sam, saying, what about World War One? Thank you, Sam. He says the program's great, but and that we should have another session. Well, listen, one of the reasons we didn't include World War One, the Great War, was because actually Dr. Stephen and I have done two shows previously marking that time in history, last year marking the centenary of the Great War. So if you want to listen to those shows, they're up on our website. They've been podcast. You can check them out at dubaieye1038.com/Dubai Today. And there's a podcast link there to all of our shows and, of course, to all the shows at Dubai Eye. But for the Dubai Today ones, check out on the page. And we'll be posting up a little bit later those shows as well if you take a bit of time and want to hear more about World War One in context.
Yeah, I would just add one thing about that, that when we talk about the Congress of Vienna and we talk about what the diplomats did there, and if one gives them a little bit of credit as being successful, we often talk about the opposite for what happens after World War One, where you have probably one of the worst peace settlements of all time, which is, collectively called the Treaty of Versailles. In fact, there are five sort of basic treaties are settled in Paris at that time. They rearranged the Middle East, they rearranged Europe, and they virtually guaranteed, by blaming the entire war on Germany, that a strong German nationalist, German nationalism would be a strong force in politics in Germany for the foreseeable future. And it's not right to say the Treaty of Versailles caused Hitler to come to power, but it certainly created conditions that made for a very aggressive nationalism to be popular with German voters. It took the Depression as well to bring someone like Hitler to power. But when one looks at compares Versailles and Vienna, you get a very different kind of image of what diplomats are capable of doing.
And as you outlined earlier, one of the reasons for looking at war and the end of wars is how we remember or how we perceive. And of course, it's a lot to do with where we are from ourselves in the world as to what we will take or how we then even form our opinions and live our lives in some ways. So it's not to be underestimated, the importance of understanding your history.
Yeah, I mean, it's very important when we look at a major conflict to understand how it is we know what we know. The reason that's interesting in and of itself is how do we know things, how do people in the American South, for example, know things about the Civil War? They might learn it in a lecture, they might learn it from a movie, but there's also a chance that they will learn it from sort of handed-down stories. And the handed-down stories sometimes are enriched every year, and they're not necessarily the whole thing. And our own sort of presuppositions about what a war is, what is right, what is wrong, all of these things frame the way we assess these conflicts.
One of our listeners texted in to say, I used to think wars were great until I saw Saving Private Ryan. Horrific reality. And there's a movie that actually, it's what we call entertainment in that genre of movie making, actually for many really depicted, gave some sense of what it might have been like to be in battle, in conflict.
Yeah, the scenes, particularly on D-Day, that it shows, but also some of the other ones in the movie, brings home for some people the realities of what war would it be like. And I can tell you that in my experience of teaching, that if I simply get up and start talking about the numbers of people that have been killed in battles, it really does not get the job done. If I were to say that, start talking about in terms of numbers of football stadiums of people killed, it might begin to do it. But sometimes it is much more effective to take a look at a film or an incident and analyze it and see what the person experienced. Or another thing we've not talked about, we talk about the end of war. One thing I'd also want to mention is we talk about the end of war at the individual level. And one of the things in the war that we'll talk about in a minute that's become much better understood is post-traumatic stress syndrome. And so, for example, how do people cope, the soldiers cope, or even the people that are the traumatized populations cope year after year after year when the war is on? The war is gone. The war is still on for them.
Yeah, and for those people in the diaspora, those people that are displaced, that are not with family, with friend, or even in their own country. So there is huge ramifications to the aftermath, the aftershock of war. The history lesson we've been receiving today from Dr. Stephen is looking at end of wars, and we've been looking at the Battle of Waterloo taking place in our history, marking this year 200 years, 1815. Also 1865, which was the end of the American Civil War, and 1945, World War II, and 1975, we're going to be talking about in a moment, which is the war, Vietnam War, as we know it, the American War, as we know it. And loads of people are texting in this morning. It's absolutely phenomenal. You've been sharing your stories, recommendations when it comes to movies that feature war. Some of you are talking about the futility of war and why is that we don't learn any lessons. Kathy saying here, how it's super proof, really. However, I feel that we don't always learn from wars. Younger generations forget so easily. If only the power of love could replace the love of power. That's from Kathy this morning. And we'll be sharing more of your messages. Keep them coming in, 4001, as you know. And we were just talking there, Dr. Stephen, about understanding the impact on people. You know, we're just talking about World War II, huge demobilization of what unfolds after the war in 1945, but how those people are, the soldiers, the people that were at the front, that were battling, that go home, how are their lives? They may be suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, relationships change, relationships are formed that maybe wouldn't have been formed before. It's there's so much more to what we really know or understand of what the impact can be of war.
Yeah, and it depends. It also depends on, you know, which country you're talking about and how they fared and how what their material circumstances are. For many Americans, my father included, it was a chance to who just missed the war to go to college. That this was a chance, and peace was valued and prospered because they'd grown up in a climate of war. But it's also the case that if we talk about the veterans that come back, some of them have trouble. Some of them, we do not have the term post-traumatic stress syndrome at that point. But since we're talking movies, there's a classic scene in another movie that people have not mentioned, Patton, where Patton slaps a soldier who is basically so stressed he can't fight anymore. And so the war lives on with people, and it can live for a long, long time. Again, you're not just talking about soldiers. You're talking about people that are impacted by it in various ways, sometimes never completely overcome it. The Vietnam War was a conflict where this is best sort of understood, and it represents the sort of development of psychology as a profession and the ability to treat soldiers. But, of course, that's only the American side. If you actually talk to people, Vietnamese, they don't tend to talk about post-traumatic stress syndrome. This was something they had to do.
And that's interesting in itself, a culture, psychology, and we're looking at, you know, what it was a sad area, which is war. It's, you know, it's not good for anybody really, but yet as human beings, and we've always done it, we will have conflict and we will rise and we will, for whatever reasons, want to defeat another. And yet culturally, people approach war differently to others, depending where you're from in the world. That's an interesting area.
Yeah, I mean, even the idea of war itself as a status, as a legal entity, will vary. And that you'll find that there's a very, some have argued, a very big difference in the way Westerners conceptualize war and the way non-Westerners do. And that on the one hand, Westerners tend to emphasize this sort of big conflict, big event, whereas other non-Western ways of thinking about it tend to look at conflict itself and that it can take place over a long period of time and without quite the mobilization of human resources, and that there's quite a lot of history that follows from that dichotomy. I think that when we talk about the Vietnam War, one of the first things to remember is that is the way the world calls it because the American media shapes the perceptions of it, that people will have seen Apocalypse Now. If we want to talk about what it was like, the impact on the American soldier, you can even look at movies like The Deer Hunter or Coming Home, and there are many, many others. So that's on the one hand, but from the Vietnamese point of view, it would be called the American War, and it actually followed the war against French colonialism. And so if you go and ever get a chance to look in the museum in Hanoi, there are several museums, and one has got war trophies of shot down American aircraft and other equipment. But you also would find that it's not as big a war as this is the struggle against French colonialism, which is more seemingly a more strong existential study. for them. So you, when you went talks then about a war, the perception of where you are shapes it. The Vietnam War is different. I'll go back and call it that just so people are clear. The Vietnam War is a much smaller conflict than the other three, but it is one that is much better chronicled, okay? And so 40 years ago is when basically you could say South Vietnam ceases to exist. And it worth noting that as Vietnam consolidates, another thing is happening next door, which is the rise of the Khmer Rouge. So the cycle of violence in Asia is not over at that point. The Vietnam War is, but in fact, people in the United States were already sort of withdrawing mentally from it or before that.
Someone's texting here saying, Last Days in Vietnam is a great recent BBC documentary on the end of the Vietnam conflict. It really highlights the plight of all those involved and the futility of that particular conflict. That's from Alex. Thanks for that. P.S. Chicken Hawk is also a great read for an insight into the experience of a U.S. helicopter pilot. It's very sad, but it's a good read. Why did that war take place?
Well, that's a very good question. And let me just add one more movie real quick. Good Morning Vietnam also is one that people will enjoy. Because it also shows the plight of the people, if it does it in a fairly ironic kind of way. Why does that conflict take place? A good question. Americans asked that question as they went to the streets to protest it. But I think one would have to say its origins lie in, first of all, the Cold War and in American politics on the one hand, and the fact that when French are driven out of Vietnam, the country is not unified. There's a north and a south, and they have each a very different sort of political culture. And if the Americans had not conceptualized the world along a domino theory and that was prevalent during the Cold War, they might not have been drawn into it. So there are different points of view about why that takes place, but at no point is there sort of a declaration of war in the way that there are at the beginning of World War I, for example, or the sort of crisp beginning that people think that with Hitler's invasion of Poland. It was something that sort of happens gradually, and then it becomes very serious.
Listen now to President Richard Nixon addressing the nation on the agreement to end the war in Vietnam, January the 23rd, 1973.
I have asked for this radio and television time tonight for the purpose of announcing that we today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. The following statement is being issued at this moment in Washington and Hanoi. At 12:30 Paris time today, January 23, 1973, the agreement on ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam was initialed by Dr. Henry Kissinger on behalf of the United States and Special Advisor Lee Duc Tho on behalf of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. The agreement will be formally signed by the parties participating in the Paris Conference on Vietnam on January 27, 1973 at the International Conference Center in Paris. The ceasefire will take effect at 2400 Greenwich Mean Time, January 27, 1973. The United States and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam express the hope that this agreement will ensure stable peace in Vietnam and contribute to the preservation of lasting peace in Indochina and Southeast Asia. That concludes the formal statement.
So interesting, this address is being made January 1973.
Yeah, this is America getting ready to withdraw from Vietnam. And the idea that it was ending the conflict, I don't think anybody in Washington believed it. What it was a way to try to withdraw and save face. Nobody who studied the conflict seriously thought that it would end. It didn't necessarily mean that the North was foreordained to defeat the South. There were many people in the U.S. Congress that believed that the United States would still provide air power and do things to sort of support it. The South, but above all, this was the withdrawal of the United States from a conflict that had been whose origins preceded its entry into it.
So again, just goes to show we have the media now in place and the reality. There are incidents happening, but there are still things going on around the world that are causing conflict, and even after this event. So that's interesting in itself. We've outlined some of those areas across, like after World War II, and now looking at the Vietnam War, the American War. But what about do you know much about what actually happens when the decision is made to formally bring a close to a war. We hear there, you know, there's signatures made, there's treaties formed, but what's actually really going on, the build up to that formality and therefore afterwards?
Well, it's very interesting, and you'd have to probably get a political scientist to look at the different ways in which it can happen, but sometimes you have had a political collapse. In other cases, there has been something that triggers the end of a war that is so decisive. The atomic bomb blast would be an example. Yes, it is certainly true that when the Russians invade Manchuria, it's a big deal for the Japanese, but there's no doubt that the prospect of not only the atomic bomb blast, but the sustained pounding of Japan by American air power, this, you know, maybe from as many as 70 aircraft carriers, as well as the bases that the U.S. Came to have at that point from which it could bomb Japan, that the reality is too brutal. It also depends on the way in which the conflict is understood. In the case of World War II, the Allies demanded unconditional surrender. If you're not trying to achieve unconditional surrenders, then you have a whole series of negotiations that may take place. For example, the Versailles Treaty, the Germans didn't like it. The Germans, quite rightly, wanted to resist it. They were given a 24-hour ultimatum. Either you take the treaty or you'll be invaded. So there are different situations in which this takes place, but usually it becomes it's not usually up to the generals, unlike the Napoleonic era, as much as it becomes up to political establishments rather than even individual politicians.
So taking a look at end of wars and what we can take from them, but also, as you said earlier, Dr. Stephen, it's about, you know, how we remember, how things are documented, and also understanding the lessons that we can learn. One of our listeners texted in to say it's also, you know, about highlighting why many wars in the past have happened. This person's saying in many wars it's greed and putting the interest of few people there, especially countries who have colonized others. Not sure how many of the people of the respective countries understand that. That's something you carry, the legacy of the culture and country that you come from through history. And also that what this person's saying is how many countries are left impoverished as a result of war.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point. And one other thing I'd mention, maybe should have said it earlier, It's interesting to talk about how wars end. It's equally interesting to talk about how they start, because the scary thing, and it should scare everybody who's listening today, not because of anything in the world right now, but if you look at a lot of wars are started when the political planners or the generals thought it was going to be something limited, and then it became something much bigger, and then it became more complicated, and then the reality of war sets in. So there's very, you know, scholars have looked at the origins of war, and that's a much more complicated thing than people recognize. The other thing that we might talk about is what happens to people during the fighting who are not themselves combatants. And so the domestic fronts in these conflicts is something historians are starting to study more aggressively than they used to.
And as we were talking there about the war in Vietnam with America, that's also a time where, and I started the show with Bob Dylan, you know, with what people deem to be the protest song that is blowing in the wind. And I've looked at Woodstock festivals like that. You know, the 60s in America was a time where culturally, popular culture was showing people wanting peace and going against war. And you could say that, again, was to do with communications. People were more aware. They're seeing footage. The television now is in most people's households in America. And also you've got youth, and we haven't touched on youth, and it was up there on one of the top of my lists actually, is that on all war throughout the centuries, how it impacts on young people, because they will be the generation moving forward after war. So if you're looking at Vietnam, those students, those young people that were growing up watching the footage, and they're not only in America, you've got to also look culturally then at what was happening in Vietnam too for the young people there. And it's a completely different environmental and cultural landscape that the young people are growing up in after their wars.
Well, one of the things that is so interesting about the Vietnam conflict is exactly the youth that are involved. It is because it's also the era of the baby boomer. It is also, if we look a little further away, it's also consistent at the time of the Cultural Revolution, where the youth of China play an incredible role in a very decisive event and very, very disturbing event in some ways. And so it's a, there is a coming of age that for youth in the West, 1968 is a very big year in Europe as well. So one of the things to remember is that youth and war do go together. And in fact, the other way to look at it is to remember, if we go back to World War I for just a second, the sort of, you know, all quiet on the Western Front, and in World War II, the zeal with which many people served and signed up when the war came to their doorstep. So it is a very interesting sort of thing to look at just by itself.
Mm. One of our listeners texted in earlier making a good point. If we're talking about movies, and really what they're getting at is how we then become, we then start stereotyping cultures and people and nationalities based on those popular cultural movies we've grown up with. So things like, you know, Germans are bad and Americans are heroes, because that's what's been fed through the movies they've been watching.
Yeah, and one of the things is, I love that insight. And one of the things that's also very interesting is when you look, if you ever get a chance to look at war films that are made during a war. So one of the ones that I always sticks in the back of my mind, The Sands of Iwo Jima, John Wayne, big, tall American hero, fighting the Japanese, the body language of the soldiers, they slither along like snakes. Mm. They're, you know, all the stereotypes you'd ever want to see. And it's one of the reasons why, I've forgotten the exact titles, but I really liked what Clint Eastwood tried to do a number of years ago by talking about the Battle of Iwo Jima in two movies, one from a Japanese point of view and one from an American point of view. And both kind of ended up humanizing their subjects a little bit, even as they showed some very despicable things that both sides did. But it's at least an awareness that the listener's quite right, that war sets up stereotypes that often don't die.
Chris says that he read an article recently that argued that Japan surrendered because of the Soviets invading northern Manchuria, not because of the atomic bombs.
There's some truth in it. I think that Japan is facing such devastation that the atomic bomb blasts are ultimately the game changer. But there's no doubt that they're very worried about what the Russians might do. They are worried that the Russians will take Manchuria. They're also concerned that the Russians can conceivably do more than that. I think that they're probably, you would find if you look at the archival records, that there is some debate about it even within Japanese circles. But I think that the atomic bomb blasts are game changers, even though the more significant bombings in terms of loss of life are actually the fire raids on Tokyo a few months earlier.
I was looking at, in history, battles of significance, and there's the Austria-Ottoman Wars going way back, 1529, and Battle 10 of Vienna. We've talked about the Battle of Waterloo this morning. Battles that stand out in your mind with the studies that you've done, Dr. Stephen?
Well, I, you know, like a lot of people that grew up enjoying history, maybe it's more males than females. Battles are one of the first things you study, and they make a big impression. So if I have to name a few real quickly, Stalingrad, absolutely a fascinating battle. I would also say Battle of Trafalgar, where Nelson defeats Napoleon. Battle of Midway, where the Japanese are defeated by the Americans. Also, no conversation would be on this topic would be correct without mentioning Battle of Cannae, where Hannibal wins, and a movie that didn't come up but always stayed in my imagination. Movie's 300, and it's where the Spartans ultimately lose to the Persians, but do so in such a way as to affect the outcome of the larger conflict between Athens and Sparta. Between the Persians and the Greeks, sorry.
So, thank you. One person here is saying, you know, you have to be careful whether Hollywood can glorify war,
yes,
and also justify their actions. And, you know, it's true, countries can rewrite their version of events through popular culture and media.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why it's very good. I think the war films that people have liked have been the ones that have maybe done some of that, but have also at least portrayed some of the really devastating effects of war. It is unfortunately true that many nation states have used war to mobilize people's identities behind them. And so war is, in fact, a useful thing for those who try in power, and it probably always will be. So, yes, and Hollywood can glorify. Hollywood can also make it very silly, by the way. But I think the best war films strike a pretty good balance of these things.
And for those who think, you know, war is such a terrible thing, and of course it is, and actually we don't want to talk about it or know about it because it's something that almost brings it into your sphere, if you like, and it's something to be afraid of. And it's when we look at history, not to be afraid, but to know and understand what is part of your history. It's all our history, even if it's happened before we were even born.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I was come back to is ultimately one of the jobs of a historian is to desanitize the past. And so, you know, if you had lived in a European city in 1920 or 1945 or 46, you probably would see lots of people who had lost limbs. You would see all sorts of visible reminders. When someone makes a Hollywood movie about it, World War One or World War II, two generations later, you might have no clue about that. So one of the jobs of history, of historians, whether they're writing or speaking on radio or teaching, is to try to desanitize an overly romantic view of the past because it undermines the mission of not only history, but really the human suffering and the dignity of human survival in the face of great odds sometimes.
Stephen, before I let you go, a message come in from Syed saying, I wanted to say your knowledge is amazing. I also read history, but more on India and Pakistan, because that's where I'm from Pakistan. I wanted to know if you've done any work or on history of the subcontinent.
I've done some. I enjoy it. And let me just tell you that one of the great things that I was able to participate in at AUS was a course called Trauma and History, where we looked at the impact of the partition on refugees. My colleague Sabrina Schultz was a psychologist. We taught the course together. I also did a course on imperialism. It looks a lot on British India. And one more thing, when we talk about British Burma, it was actually part of British India. So I really enjoy the history and historiography of the Indian Ocean.
Dr. Stephen Keck, Professor of History and Academic